Part 30. Monday, March 18th. A pretty ordinary day at work. The real event was opening the post when I got home. A letter from Joseph. 312 9 Street Northwest. Calgary, Alberta. Canada. Dear Ted. It was a great relief to get your letter. We had written two to your Bitten address. One actually came back marked bombed out deceased. The other got no reply. Truly we wondered what had happened and we started to make plans to come to England as soon as travel was possible. That is now, most fortunately, unnecessary, though the loss of Agnes and Margaret must surely be most painful to you. It is a pity we never knew them, having emigrated before you married. I hope we can reconnect, and that we can meet up again. It seems a long time ago. Caroline and I read and reread your description of what has been happening to you. I'll bring you up to date on our story. There was a quite long description of what had happened to them. Joe was a manager with the Calgary Transit System. His wartime was spent keeping aging buses and trams working. He called the trams streetcars. Their two children were now grown. The girl, Martha, was 25 and married with children. Her husband had served in the Canadian Navy, but on the west coast of Canada on an armed fishing boat. Lucky, because he avoided any real action. Their son, Jeffrey, was now 18, so he just missed being called up, though Canada had had a lot of trouble over conscription, and conscripts were not supposed to serve outside of Canada. Still, it was good that they were safe. Jeffrey would likely go to the University of Alberta in the autumn. Canada seemed to have more opportunity for young people than England. I shared the letter with Maud. A few days before I'd bought a bottle of sherry on a whim. We opened it and had a small toast to reconnections. I wrote back that night to let Joseph know I'd got his letter. From there onwards we had a fairly regular correspondence. Part 31. By Easter, I was becoming settled in my routine. We'd dug the garden and done some planting. I even went to the crater, as I thought of it, and dug out some raspberry canes and put them in 161's garden. World events were observed from the distance of newspaper articles or the BBC News. We didn't take part in jitterbug dancing, but read about it. We noted, rather than felt, Churchill's famous Iron Curtain speech in Missouri. Both Maud and I felt we would have liked to have seen the Sleeping Beauty performed by the Royal Ballet at Covent Garden, though neither of us had ever seen a ballet. A week after I'd been bicycle making with Ralph, there was a terrible disaster at the Burnden Park football stadium. 33 dead and over 300 injured. And the game went on after the corpses were laid out on the touchline. Too many fans tried to get into part of the stadium and people were crushed to death or badly injured. There was going to be an inquiry, but that wouldn't raise the dead. On the Ides of March, Attlee announced that Britain would grant India its independence. Maybe this would let Fred Brownlow come home. On the 24th of March, we heard Alastair Cook's American letter. We both rather liked it, and we'll have to watch the Radio Times for when it is on next. On Good Friday, Maud and I had hot cross buns for breakfast. A particular treat I'd found in a local baker's. We were sharing a third bun with a second cup of tea when we heard the bell of an emergency vehicle. I went out the front door to see an ambulance in front of a house a few doors down the street. I came back in and told Maud. She stuffed the remaining portion of her half of the bun in her mouth and put on her coat. I copied her and we went down the street, where a clutch of neighbors were gathered, including Mrs. Brownlow and Jack. A policeman arrived and went inside. After about 10 minutes, the ambulance men carried out a stretcher with a covered body. That was not a good sign. The policeman followed the ambulance men out of the house, but came over to our group of neighbors. Is anyone here acquainted with Mrs. Bonin? He pronounced it Bonin, but we later learnt it was French and pronounced Bon-An. Maud said, I used to talk to her at church, and my daughter used to mind her great-niece Paula sometimes. Perhaps you might go inside in a minute and see if you can help the girl compose herself. The great-aunt appears to have died this morning of a stroke. We'll have to see if we can find the girl's family. They were waiting for the Red Cross to see if they could be found, Maud said. Paula's father was Jewish, and in early 1940, as a precaution, Mrs. Bonin, who was originally English. She told me her name was Moore. And was widowed, decided to come back to England. She brought Paula with her, and almost immediately we had Dunkirk. Apparently Paula's parents were grabbed by the Nazis sometime a bit later, I think 1942. Lord Belpas, the policeman said. There are some emergency services for child protection, but the proper people won't be at work until Tuesday. I don't want to leave the girl here until then. The house is split into rooms, and a couple of them are single men. They're probably harmless, but we can't take chances. So I'm wondering if she can stay with someone nearby until Tuesday. Maud whispered to me, Ted, would you be upset if we set up a cot in the kitchen for her? That seems a possibility. Why don't you suggest it? Constable, I think I can offer space in my kitchen, which has a boiler and is relatively warm. We might need to move Paula's bed, though. Thank you, madam. May I have your name and address? Mrs. Maud Crichton, 161, Radstock Road. And this is your husband? No, this is Mr. Edward Newman, my lodger. The policeman's eyebrows raised a little at this. I said I've recently been demobbed to return to Supermarine. Mrs. Crichton fortunately had space since my house was the victim of a V1 and... Ah, yes. I'm very sorry for your loss, Mr. Newman. I was the constable sent out that day. Should we ask Paula if she's agreeable to stay with us for a while? I asked. It seemed to me important that the girl feel that she had some choice. Perhaps Mrs. Crichton could go in and suggest that, then we'll work out a tentative plan of action, the constable said. While Maud was inside, I took the opportunity to get the constable's name, which was Murray, and the station from which he worked so we could ensure communication. There would no doubt be some confusion and Paula might be lost in the shuffle. After a few minutes, Maud and Paula, who we had not seen until now, came out with a small suitcase. She was a girl of about 12 or 13, wearing a simple pinafore skirt and blouse under her coat. As we made the short walk back to 161, Maud explained, I've locked up. We'll give Paula something to eat and figure out how we'll manage until Tuesday at least. Paula said nothing. Her eyes were red, but for now she wasn't crying. We came into the house and I put on the kettle and toasted a pair more hot cross buns. We sacrificed a bit of our butter ration for Paula. After she had consumed these and drunk some tea, I decided to see what we could learn about the girl. Paula, can you tell us about yourself, and we'll see what we can work out to keep you safe and sound? Aunt Matilda brought me here from France in 1940. My parents have been taken somewhere by the Germans. We have asked the Red Cross where they may be, but so far nothing. How does your aunt provide for you? I suppose I should use the past tense, but too late now. She has some money in the bank. I don't think a lot, as we live in just one room, and we share the WC with the others in the house, and we cook on a gas ring by the gas fireplace. But it eats shillings, so we are often cold. Do you know if there are any other family members in either England or France? I don't think so. I asked Aunt Matilda once, and she said they all died. She said her family died in the influenza of 1919. Do you know if the furniture in your room is your aunt's? Maud asked. I think it is all Aunt Matilda's. Because it is possible you don't have other family, we had better see if we can find your aunt's bank book and other documents, as well as any of your own, I said. After a bit of discussion, we headed back to the house where Paula and her great-aunt had their room. Paula had her own set of keys. Maud had that of the aunt. As we opened the front door, there was a man trying to open the door of one of the rooms. What are you doing, Mr. Hetherington? Paula asked. Nothing. Nothing. Thought you might need help. I said, Mr. Hetherington, I will state right now that I intend to inform the constable who was here that I and Mrs. Crichton observed you trying to gain entry to the room of Paula and her aunt, with the possibility that your intent was to rob them. No. Don't do that. I didn't mean any harm. Figured the old biddy wouldn't be needing anything now and the girl'd be looked after properly. I'm a pensioner and don't owe anything. Well, if. And that is a conditional statement. If Paula tells me nothing is missing today or later, then I will not submit a report to the police. That means not only missing due to your efforts, but to any other intruders. For your efforts, Mr. Hetherington, you are now the watchman. All right. All right. Don't get your knickers in a twist. I'll go back to my own room, and I'll keep an eye out that nobody steals her miserable rubbish. Hetherington disappeared upstairs and we unlocked the room. Paula went to a chest of drawers and opened the top one and pulled out a bank book. Here's Aunt Matilda's bank book. Do you want to see it? We'll look at it together later. Do you have a bag we can put it and any other important things inside? We'll take them with us, make a list and some notes, but you can keep hold of them. I'm afraid you are rather going to have to act like a grown-up, Paula. But I think that will be better than being treated like a baby. Yes, I suppose. She didn't seem sure. In the top drawer were also some documents. We found Paula's identity card. I noted her name was Paul Ronan. And her French birth record, some letters, and some photographs. Also the rent book. It had been paid for a week on Thursday. No. Paid until the following Friday. The rent collector had come early because of Easter. Paula knew where Matilda's handbag was kept in a small cupboard and we found Matilda's identity card inside. Matilda Bonin, aged 74. Along with a wallet purse, with a small amount of money and her and Paula's ration books and coupons. I suggested Paula take Matilda's handbag and eventually use it for herself. I had a notebook and we made a list of things in the room. We gathered some more clothes for Paula and put them in a pillowcase. There were two beds in the room. The one Paula said she used was a very simple cot that could be folded. We probably could have done the moving of the cot and important items in one trip, but decided to take two. When we were back in 161 with the cot, I asked Maud if there were space in the front room to put one of the wingback chairs. The kitchen would be too crowded otherwise. I've not been in that room for over a year, and then only because Jenny heard noises. It was mice, and we put down some poison. I suggested we'd better take a look. Maud got a candle. I could, I suppose, have got the German dynamo torch I had picked up in Belgium from a POW. It fit in your palm and you squeezed a flat paddle to spin the dynamo inside. A bit noisy and the light was uneven, but it did work and didn't need batteries. Or there was my bike lamp. Oh well, the candle was lit now. The door was stiff from not having been used. Inside the room was essentially empty. The ceiling was missing some plaster where it was clear some shrapnel had come through the window and sliced through the light fitting. There were big gouges out of two of the walls. The frame of the window was gone and the inside of the makeshift cover was all that could be seen. A desiccated mouse corpse was near the fireplace that was blocked like that in my room. I said we could sweep and then use this for storage. And perhaps contact the council to ask if they'd either do some repairs or let us do them. In my mind, I thought possibly it would allow for other options, but then again, the council might say a complete house should be given to a family and Maud and I would have to move. Yes. Paula, hold the candle. I'll get a broom and dustpan and bucket, Maud said. We did a peremptory sweep to get the worst dust out. It had clearly been swept earlier of the plaster and debris from the bomb damage. The dust was bad, and we opened the front door, which allowed some light into the room too. Then we moved one of the wingback chairs into this room and closed the door again. Paula and I set up her cot where the wingback chairs had been in the corner. It just fit, possibly a bit close to the cooking stove, but it was in. We put the remaining wingback chair in front of the boiler. It was going to be a bit awkward. One of us would have to sit on the bed, the other in the chair, and one at the table if we were all in the room and wanted to be close to the heat. Well, it was now spring. Maud put on a cup of tea, the universal response in England to any difficult situation. A knock at the door came as we were just taking our first sips of tea and finishing the last of a packet of rich tea I'd managed to buy at work from an informal and almost certainly dubious source among the workers under my general command, moreover at double the official price. Ah. Constable Murray. What can we do for you? Well, Mr. Newman, my sergeant pointed out that we have a deceased person and we need to establish that there are natural causes. If it wouldn't be too disturbing for the young lady, I'd like to ask her some questions. I'll be as gentle as I can. I ushered Murray into the kitchen. Paula, I'm sure you heard what Constable Murray said. Do you think you can try to tell him what he needs to know? I think so. It didn't seem much different than once before. Murray said, "Why don't you just tell us in your own words and I'll make some notes?" Well, I woke up when I heard Aunt Matilda making some noises, like grunting. She did that a month ago, and had some trouble speaking for most of a morning, and her left leg seemed to not work. Then this morning the same, but her face was crooked, and then she sort of went to sleep and I noticed she wasn't breathing, so I got dressed as quickly as I could and went to the telephone box and called 999. Thank you, Paula. Oh. I need your last name. It's Ronan. R-O-N-E-N. My father's family was Polish and moved to France where he was born. But they were originally also Jewish, which is why Aunt Matilda brought me here in 1940, just before she started to cry. Maud put her arms round her. Murray said, "I'm sorry to hear all that, but you have been very brave to tell me everything. I think we have enough information to guess that Mrs. Bonin had a stroke or something like it. Unfortunately, we have to be sure." "Where have they taken Mrs. Bonin's body?" I asked. "I was told the hospital mortuary. It's likely the coroner will have to provide information for a death certificate, then the body will be released for a funeral. I know you and Mrs. Crichton are, well, you've been kind to Paula, but perhaps you and Paula can talk about that, especially if there's enough money to cover the costs." "We'll talk about it," I said, and Maud nodded. We said goodbye and I closed the door behind him. I thought that actually he could have been more thorough, given that the symptoms might hide a poisoning, such as accidental ingestion of something like Maud said she had used in the front room to get rid of mice. Well, it didn't change the facts on the ground that Paula had lost her aunt. Part 32. We went back again to Paula's room to get the modest bits of food that were there, as well as much of any items of clothing, bedding, towels, and objects that might be of value for Paula. Maud had an old suitcase, and my kit bag was now empty, which allowed for easy transport. I'd found a small chest of drawers for my room in the last couple of weeks. It had needed some repairs, but the Supermarine people were good about leaving some metal strapping and screws in a newspaper on my desk after I'd talked about it over dinner one day. Paula's stock of fresh food was some bread and milk, a tiny piece of cheese, 2 onions, 4 carrots, 3 potatoes, and some mushrooms. More useful were 2 cans of baked beans, 1 of corned beef, and 1 of the Nestle sweetened condensed milk. On our return to 161, we spent some time talking about the meals we would have until Tuesday, when hopefully we would learn more about what needed to be done. "What'll happen to me now Aunt Matilda is dead?" Paula asked. Maud looked like she was about to make some comforting noises, but I realized honesty with compassion would be more kind in the long run, so I said, "I think that the first thing that has to be arranged is your aunt's funeral. I have met a Mr. Beeston, who was the undertaker for my wife and daughter, and I'll be willing to help you with that. But as Constable Murray said, there has to be a death certificate. I had to get one of those each for my wife and daughter recently." "Oh, yes. I knew about them. I'm sorry. I was..." "That's all right. You're probably in shock. We'll try to make this weekend as ordinary as possible for you, and assume that on Tuesday things will start to get arranged." "Where will I live?" "I honestly don't know. I suspect you shouldn't stay where you have been. Hetherington and whoever else is there aren't reliable neighbors, I fear." Paula nodded. "Do you know if your aunt had a will?"
"She never mentioned a will."
"No doubt we'll need to arrange that you have whatever money and possessions she had. I'm willing to help you sort that out, though we may need a solicitor to do the forms."
"Are you going to school?"
"Yes, I go to the secondary school. I've 1 more year until I can leave. Aunt Matilda was very upset that school finishes here so young. In France, she said I would have gone to the lycée and then to university." "Yes, there's Butler's new plan, but things got messed up with the war. I went to grammar school, then was apprenticed in engineering at Supermarine. I was lucky. I left at 14, Maud said. Worked at one of the department stores, then met Jeremy and we got married. Sometimes wish I'd had more schooling."
"I believe you go to church at St. Patrick's, Paula?"
"Yes. I was baptized in France. I've seen you and Mrs. Crichton at Mass. In fact, on St. Patrick's Day when there was tea after the Mass, because it was special. We'll go together Sunday. Perhaps we'll write a note to the priest to ask for prayers for your aunt."
"Hmm.
Maud, do you know where the priest lives or how he is contacted?" "It's written on the notice on the front of the church where they give information on services."
"Oh.
Right. I should have registered that when I looked the night I came here. We'll write a note then go and find where we have to deliver it. That will give us a walk this afternoon." Part 33. The weekend was one of waiting for Tuesday. We went for some walks. We did some gardening, and Paula seemed to like that. On Saturday, I went out to get some bread and managed to find a small, very small, Easter egg at the newsagent's. It cost me a coupon as well as a shilling. Still, something for Paula. She was very emotional about it, and at supper insisted we all have a piece. A moment to remember. On Monday, we looked at the letters we'd gathered from Paula's room. That's what we called it now. We'd have to decide whether to pay the rent on Friday. To forestall the matter, we pinned a note to the door of the room asking the rent collector to contact me at Supermarine since Mrs. Bonin had died. We decided to empty the room and store things in the front room of 161. In the unlikely situation that Paula went back to the room, we could return things.
The letters were of four main types. First, some letters from Paula's parents. I had some large envelopes that had already been used that I'd salvaged at work, so we put the family letters in one of those and labeled it. Similarly, we put all the letters from the Red Cross in another. There were just a few, and they really didn't say much, though they did give the office address and a name. I had Paula write a letter saying her aunt had died and that she should be contacted via Maud at 161 Radstock Road, or by telephone via me at my office number. Mrs. Bonin had a fountain pen in her handbag. We cleaned and refilled it. There was a bottle of ink that we found when we went back to the room for more things. And Paula wrote this letter. Good job I'd bought some more paper and envelopes, and we had some stamps. Odd, I said we, though it was actually me. The third group of letters were about Paula's status. It seemed that Her Majesty's government had decided, sometime in 1943, that Paula could be considered a bona fide displaced person and she had been granted residency in the UK, with Matilda her guardian. I put these letters and documents in another envelope and marked them status. There would be a change of some sort regarding the guardianship. Finally, there were letters to and from friends, mostly in France. These were primarily in French. Paula said, should I write to them? There seemed to be quite a few. At least a dozen people. Why don't you write down a standard letter saying your great aunt has died and put it in French and English? Then when we have better information about where you'll be, we can copy the text for each, starting with the addresses that have the most recent dates. Some are surely no longer valid. That makes sense. My French is all in my ear. I need to use the dictionary. I think we brought it over. We've cleared the room except for your aunt's bed and the chest of drawers. I'll get some friends to help with those tomorrow or Wednesday, so the room is empty. We'll use the front room for storage. Part 34. Tuesday I went to work as usual, and we had quite a bit of catch-up to do from the holiday weekend break. At dinner, I sat with Charlie and told him of the events on Radstock Road. He said he'd come round this evening with his son or a friend and help me move the last items from Paula's room. Good old Charlie. But the more important events of the day were not revealed to me until I got home. There you are, Ted. We've a lot to tell you, Maud said. Let me wash up and I'll be all ears. By the time I came down to the kitchen and we were sitting round the table. A third chair from Paula's room was now in use too. There was a cup of tea poured for me. Maud said, with Paula listening intently, and Mrs. Carberry from the welfare came by at about 10:30 to inquire about Paula. We talked for about an hour. In the middle, a man came from the mortuary. The coroner has declared death by natural causes and they wanted to know where to send Mrs. Bonin's body. You'd suggested Beeston's, so Paula and I both signed a form that they would take charge. I hope I did right. I guess signing means I'm responsible for paying. If I can use Aunt Matilda's money, you shouldn't have to, Paula said. It wouldn't be right. I joined in on that front. I remembered the name of the solicitor Agnes and I used when we bought our house. He's now died, but his son is in practice and his secretary said they'd be happy to take on any necessities. She had been there when Agnes and I did our house purchase, and she remembered us and said she'd make sure the fees were as small as they could be. Oh, that's helpful, Maud said. I'm certain the money will be important to Paula. Now Mrs. Carberry seemed very uncertain what would happen regarding Paula, though she was quite adamant that Paula would have a place to stay and proper food and safety. But it seems there are several complications. First, Paula is older than most children coming under the umbrella of the welfare. They have very few places for a girl her age. Then too, she is technically a French citizen, though she has residency in the United Kingdom. Third, her parents are missing, so guardianship is uncertain. Fourth, she has some money, which seems to be more problem than being destitute for some technical reason. And finally, it seems clear they would try to oppose her staying in the room. Then the man from the hospital mortuary arrived, and we had to sort that out. After he left, I asked whether Paula could remain with us, at least until she left school and got a job. Mrs. Carberry thought that a good idea until she asked about my husband. The whole story took quite a long time to tell, and I could see she thought it unsatisfactory for a girl of 13, well, almost 13, to be living with two people who were of opposite sex and not married. I also mentioned that there was the front room if we could get it fixed up. That actually might work, but Mrs. Carberry said there was a big waiting list for council repairs. I said I'd meant to call the council to ask about that, though really since you are the tenant it should be you. However, I've the office telephone, so I'll do it tomorrow. At least I can find out what the policies and situation are. But it wouldn't surprise me that there's a long wait, and we probably don't have the luxury of much time. Maud said anyway, I asked Mrs. Carberry if she had anything to offer Paula right now, and the only choice would be some sort of emergency hostel, but that is more or less for homeless people, or else a camp for displaced persons. So I said would the present arrangement be acceptable for the time being? She hemmed and hawed, but said there didn't seem to be much else, and it would save a lot of bother if we were willing. Unfortunately, the new family allowance won't give anything until there are two children in the house. I think there'll be enough money. What about any legal requirements? I asked. Actually, I completed a temporary guardianship form she had. Did the two of you manage to get to shopping today with all this going on? Yes, we did. Paula didn't go to school today. I thought she should be here. Oh. And Mr. Beeston dropped by this afternoon to say he would take care of funeral arrangements. I asked him to please keep the funeral as modest as possible. There was a knock on the door. I went and opened it, and it was the parish priest, Father Walsh. I brought him in. I can't stay long, as there's a parishioner needing the last rites. I'm only sorry I missed that sacrament for your aunt, Miss Ronan. However, given the request for prayers yesterday, some parishioners have indicated that they wish to help out in a more worldly way, and I wanted to let you know that there will be a small fund to help cover funeral costs, and you should ask me in a few days, and I'll give you the money. I've also reserved a time on Saturday coming for a Requiem Mass. If the undertaker can manage that time, it could also be used as a funeral service. However, given we're using the school, it may be a bit difficult to coordinate with them. Possibly we'll have a separate committal at the grave. Thank you, Father Walsh. It's all very confusing just now. Well, it seems you are being cared for here. I know the history of Mrs. Crichton and Mr. Newman. They have had their own sorrows. But I must be along. Good luck to you all. And he was gone in a whoosh of his cassock. He nearly knocked over Charlie and his son David. Paula and I went with them, and within a quarter hour we'd moved the remainder of the objects from the rented room to the front room of 161. David said this room wouldn't take that much to put in order, at least to be functional. Wouldn't be country life or such, but could work as a bedroom or a parlor. Just need to work out a new frame for some glass. I think the council wants to put it back the way it was, and that gets in the way of a quick fix, I commented. Ah, yes. The council poo bars never can just get on with it, Charlie opined. They wanted to be off. Apparently some sort of darts tournament at one of the pubs, so I thanked them profusely and they left. My goodness. Do you think we'll get a chance to eat supper? I asked coming back into the kitchen. I've made a sort of shepherd's pie with the corned beef Paula had. We sat down and ate, largely in silence. We were all a bit exhausted from the day. After supper, I decided to go for a walk. Paula was preparing her satchel for school in the morning. Maud was sorting laundry, which we'd all helped to do yesterday. That was Monday, when Maud did the wash, but of course also a holiday. Also, Maud wanted to wash all the linen from Paula's room. I don't know if this embarrassed Paula. She'd been a bit odd about a bath on Saturday. We decided then, because the hot water might not run, to 3 baths on Sunday. I wondered how the fuel ration would work. We ought to get a bit more for the 3 of us. I might have to explore the informal sector for fuel. Or try some of the old RAF tricks. One of my lacs had a neat way of using a dried turf of grass and a small copper pipe attached to a can of used engine oil. The pipe was set to drip oil into the turf, which he put in a grate and lit. Gave pretty good heat. Not as smoky as one would imagine. I'd have to look around. There was probably a bit of used oil at the works that could be liberated. The war had awakened my larcenous streak. And there was quite a lot of coal dust in the shed. A bit of cement powder and some cardboard for a form, and I could make some bricks that would burn in the boiler, cardboard and all. Part 35. I was in bed by about 10, being rather tired. I had an Agatha Christie novel I was reading and was about to turn off the lamp I'd managed to find that was on a small bedside table I'd also acquired secondhand, when there was a soft knock on my door. "Yes," I said. "May I come in?" Maud responded. "Of course." She came in. I wanted to ask if it was all right that I told Mrs. Carberry that Paula could stay. "Yes. I'd have done the same." I motioned for her to sit on the edge of the bed. "Oh. That's a relief. I was worried it might annoy you that she's now in the kitchen and we're all rather crammed in." "We'll manage, and perhaps the front room can be fixed up. I'll start asking tomorrow." "Do you think the welfare will kick up a lot of fuss that Paula's here with 2 unmarried people? "It's a worry, especially if they force her into a hostel that truly is unsuitable, and all to maintain some appearance of propriety," Maud said. "There's lots got to happen before they do that, I should think. And it means work for types like your Mrs. Carberry compared to just letting her stay here." "Thanks, Ted, you're a great comfort and keep me going." "It's mutual," I said. I thought of giving her a kiss. Then I realized it would only confuse things more. "Let things evolve." We didn't say goodnight. Maud just quietly got up and went to her own room. Part 36. The Requiem Mass on Saturday morning was surprisingly well attended. About 2 dozen people were there. Beeston couldn't manage to do a funeral that day. It would be Monday morning at 9. I'd told Hall I'd be away for a couple of hours, but would stay late. Maud knew, and supper would be at 7:30. With all the fuss about Mrs. Bonin and Paula, my 41st birthday had slipped by on Friday. Not a single happy birthday. In fact, I'd had no such good wishes directed to me since a card from Agnes and Peggy in 44. In my dinner hour on the Tuesday after the funeral, Maud and I met Paula at the offices of Mr. Rushworth, the solicitor. I brought along all the documents I could think of, including a death certificate that Beeston passed to us. Rushworth said he should be able to sort things out fairly quickly, then asked for some document showing that one of us had temporary guardianship for Paula. Maud fortunately had put this in her handbag, and Rushworth took it and gave her a receipt for it. "The bank may quibble, but the amounts are not huge, and I know the manager, Mr. McKenzie." "He knows me too," I said. "Good, it will oil the works. Now, Miss Ronan, do you want to take over the account or put the money in something like the post office?" The post office is open longer hours, aren't they?
It's hard to get to the bank when I'm at school except for Saturday, Paula said.
That's a good point. I suggest that you open an account if you don't have one, so when we get the money you can put it in easily.
I thought Paula was showing a great deal of maturity. There had been some tears at the Requiem Mass, and glistening eyes at the committal.
Beeston must be well connected with Father Walsh, because when I approached him discreetly after the coffin had been lowered.
Again at Hollybrook.
To ask about payment, he said not to worry. The parishioner's collection was a bit less than our regular fee, but enough to cover costs.
I've already told Father Walsh there'll be nothing owing.
And you've enough knowledge of the world to know that I'll probably get more business when Walsh tells people about my gesture than I'd ever make from collecting the difference.
Part 37. My inquiries about fixing up the front room met with great sympathy and equally great inaction, or rather inability to act. It seemed that there were lots of regulations and policies, or at least perceived ones. Unless the council workman did the job, there was inordinate fear of corruption. But the council workman had been largely drawn into the forces and some still weren't demobbed. The ones left were old, lazy, possibly incompetent, or all of the above. After a couple of phone calls, I decided this was not a profitable pursuit.
We went to Mass together.
Well, I'd been going with Maud since I arrived back in Southampton, but Paula came with us today, as she had the week before.
Father Walsh caused me a bit of a shock and some shame when he started his homily.
My dear parishioners, this week marks a year since the end of hostilities in Europe. It did not mark the end of fighting, and certainly not the end of suffering. Tomorrow also marks the anniversary of our loss of Jenny Crichton, who was a member of this congregation. I ask your prayers for her and her family.
He went on to remind us of the need to remember and to work for peace and for reconstruction.
I glanced sideways at Maud. She was stony-faced, with a tear starting at the corner of the eye I could see. I felt angry that there was nothing I could do to ease her pain.
As we walked home, I asked Maud, "Do you want to go to Hollybrook or do anything particular to remember Jenny?"
"I think I should put some flowers on her grave. I'll go there tomorrow."
"Would today be better?"
"I could come with you. It feels important."
Paula was walking behind us. The pavement was too narrow for three. In fact, it was quite narrow for the two of us. She said, "Unless you'd like to be alone, I'd like to come too, and I have school tomorrow."
"Thank you both," Maud said.
"Yes.
Let's go this afternoon."
Part 38. Paula's letter to the Red Cross must have prompted someone to check some files, because on Friday, May 24, she got a letter.
It was not good news.
British Red Cross. Family Reunification Unit. May 20, 1946. Miss Paula Ronan. Care of Mrs. M. Crichton. 161 Radstock Road. Woolston, Hampshire. Dear Miss Ronan, with sadness, I am writing to you to let you know that we have information from former inmates of German concentration camps about your parents. It appears that your mother, Maria Ronan, died on or about the 31st of October, 1943 in Auschwitz, almost immediately on her arrival there. Your father Theo, most tragically, died at Belsen on the 18th of April last year, just after the liberation by the British Army. Unfortunately, his name was misspelled and we only very recently corrected the documentation. Your father was, sadly, one of nearly 14,000 prisoners who have died since the camp was liberated. I recognize the extreme weight of this letter and can only wish for a brighter future for you, Yours truly. Anna Radetska, Miss. We stayed quiet while Paula read the letter. Then she passed it to me and Maud, and I read it together. I think we both expected Paula to weep, but she simply said, "I already knew they were dead. I dreamt it. But I didn't know when or where. Perhaps there would be delayed consequences. We could only try to be attentive and supportive. It was one of the days when Maud and I wanted fish and chips, so I prepared to go out to get them. Almost by a sort of habit, though we'd not had much time to develop patterns, I asked if Paula wanted to come with me, and she said yes. As we walked to the chip shop, she said, "I'm not sure if I should be relieved or sad or angry or I don't know what. You'll probably be all of those in the next few weeks or months. Both Maud and I have been there. When I came in February, I used to hear Maud crying in her room. And I used to have nightmares where I would cry out. One time she had to wake me up. Now I still have the dreams, but I seem to be able to wake myself. Thanks, Mr. Newman. Perhaps it's time to call me Ted. And we'll see if Mrs. Crichton wants you to call her Maud. I think that Red Cross letter and the way you handled reading it means you've mostly grown up. And grown up far too quickly." "Yes. I suppose I have." I added, "I already talked to Maud about this, but you may not know that today is the 5th anniversary of the sinking of HMS Hood." "Oh no. I didn't realize, or I would have expressed my sympathies." "We're going to have a small glass of sherry and toast the men of the Hood after tea," I said. Part 39. To give ourselves a bit of a change, we took the train to Winchester on the Sunday. We had afternoon tea in a small cafe. It wasn't very good. There was a so-called Battenberg cake, but any hint of almond in the fake marzipan was inhaled in one breath. But we did have an outing. The cathedral and the old town were a pleasant diversion. We were waiting for the Paula penny to drop, I think, though I cannot say it ever did, at least not in any stereotypical way. But at this point in time, we were worried that there might be some spark that would ignite a petrol vapor of overwhelming grief. As we made our way back to the station in Winchester, I saw the three of us reflected in a shop window. We looked like a regular family of father, mother, and daughter. Were we what we appeared to be? As I was about to look away from the reflection, I saw Maud looking too. She had a strange expression on her face. We were able to have a salad for supper, using some rather young lettuce and radishes from the garden. Our first produce. Maud and I took our baths in sequence. Paula's bath was now established as Saturday. Then in pajamas and dressing gowns listened to the wireless until after the news. Despite the letter on Friday, there was a gentle companionship in the kitchen. At the top of the stairs, Maud said, "I saw you looking at our reflection this afternoon, just as I was. Did it give you a funny feeling?" "Not so much funny, as familiar. We looked like a family out for an afternoon, rather than what you so aptly referred to as leftovers when I came here." "But we are leftovers, aren't we? Paula included." "Yes. Or perhaps we were, rather than we are. Time will tell, no doubt. Good night, Maud. Thank you for a nice day and a pleasant supper. Good night, Ted. Thank you too for, well, everything." Part 40. On Monday, about mid-morning, my telephone rang. "Newman here." "Hello. It's Nigel Hughes." "Nigel. Good to hear from you. We lost touch around the time of VE Day. What are you up to?" Just got demobbed a few weeks ago and got back to Leicester to take over the family scrap business.
Oh. That probably means your dad got worse. You mentioned he wasn't well, and that must have been 2 years ago.
Died actually, but in the end it was a release. But he'd had a fairly good life, so all in all not nearly as bad as for you. But that's not why I called.
All right. Better tell me. But first, give me your address and phone number.
Nigel did this, then said, "My reason for calling is that I've had a bit of good fortune. East Anglia had lots of airfields, as you know. Well, a lot of them will go back to farmland or other uses, but there's plenty of scrap and salvage."
Yes. Should be an opportunity.
Building materials like corrugated iron, pipes, probably old toilets too.
Yes, I've got some German POWs to work on that.
Labor for that sort of work is hard to come by. And the POWs are almost free if you're a skinflint, but I slip them a bit extra and they work well because they've been bored out of their minds in camps. But the salvage I wanted to talk to you about is aircraft parts.
Interesting, though here at Supermarine we're into new stuff.
Yes. I know that.
And you know that.
But we're both in the parts game, and you'll likely meet people who may want stuff I might be able to supply. Besides getting in contact again, which I really wanted to do anyway, I wanted to let you know about what I might have so the word could get out.
Yes.
It makes sense to get the word of mouth going, and I'll be sure to let anyone vaguely likely to need parts know.
Can you send me a summary of what you have?
Sure can. If that doesn't sound too Yankan expression. But top of the list are a few Merlin engines. There were plenty of crashes on landing, and while the fitters got some of the obvious salvage, we found a few buried in mud or set aside and forgotten because they were tied up in barbed wire fencing the plane had plowed through. I think we'll have the better part of a dozen complete and a fair number of parts. I'm training up some folk to clean and measure to make sure things are up to the mark.
Yes.
You don't want to sell something and have it fail. That would kill your business.
Well, you of all people will know that the value of a good part is about 1,000 times its value as plain metal, which is more or less what we're paying, though our contract is more or less, if you clean up, you get to keep the salvage.
You should be able to do very well, Nigel.
I'll keep a sharp eye out.
Be ashamed to waste some good Merlins. And we should see if we can get a chance to meet and catch up. I'd better not start in on personal history now, but I'll write.
Oh, I'll give you my personal address for non-business stuff.
I figured there might be some things that shouldn't go in letters eyes at Supermarine might see.
Nigel wrote down my address and we signed off.
It was good to reconnect with an old buddy.
Part 41.
We never quite learnt how Mrs. Carberry discovered that Paula's parents were dead. Or maybe she didn't find out, and her visit on June 3rd to talk to Maud was simply a routine one.
When I got home, Maud was upset and angry. That Mrs. Carberry just about accused me of being a whore.
Paula had been invited by a school friend down the street to listen to some records that the girl had got as a birthday present. Her parents had a gramophone.
Maud.
I doubt you'd use that word if Paula were around.
Don't make fun of me, Ted.
I'm very cross.
I know.
And I'm not making fun of you, just noting that you are generally less expressive.
She's just a self-righteous busybody.
And she has no more to offer Paula now than she did when Mrs. Bonin died.
So is she insisting on that hostile solution, if we can call it such?
Not yet. I think that it's still too much work for her and her minions. But I think she has friends over at the council who might poke their noses into our tenancy. Probably some sort of rule that a council house can't be used for unrelated people. I don't know. It just worries me.
You care about Paula?
I do. She's a good soul. And, if I'm honest, she helps me get out of the funk I was in due to Jenny's death.
I care about her too, I said.
Yes. I know. It's obvious in how you treat her. Not like a baby or an infant, either, but like a friend, which I think is very valuable to her. It could tip her over the edge if they take her away.
I care about you, too. I won't pretend to be in love with you, and I'm sure you're not in love with me. But we're friends, and I want things to go well for you.
That's about how I feel about you too, Ted.
Well, there is one solution that would put Mrs. Carberry in her place, but I don't know if any of us are ready for it.
What do you mean?
I said if we are a genuine family, the council will have no reason to question the tenancy, and the welfare authorities would have no say on taking Paula away.
The moment of realization swept over Maud's face.
You mean that you and I marry and we adopt Paula?
Assuming we all think that is a good idea. I suspect we'd be unhappy unless all the parts came together.
It's strange. If someone had suggested such an idea were a reasonable one to me in talking about someone else, like gossiping on the bus, I'd say it was foolish and stupid and...
I shut Maud up by kissing her. She kissed me back. Then we heard a key in the lock. Paula was back, since it was time for supper. We ate later than the rest of the street. I quickly whispered, "Does Paula know about Mrs. Carberry?" and Maud shook her head.
Part 42. After supper, I mentioned that Mrs. Carberry had been round. Maud said, "Now that it's known your parents are dead, there is some concern about me being temporary guardian. Not that Mrs. Carberry or anyone else has a good idea of what they want to do.
But I like it with you and Ted," Paula said in a worried voice.
"The authorities don't like us being unrelated," I contributed.
"Meaning that you and Maud aren't married but living under the same roof?"
"Yes. Most girls your age wouldn't recognize the issue," I said. "Aunt Matilda was English, but lived a long time in France. Such things are more open there, though there is still gossip.
Ted and I talked before supper about a possibility, but we'd like to know what you think."
"What about?"
"About us. The three of us. Ted and I are wondering if it makes sense for us to marry then see about adopting you so we can be a family. Adoptions generally don't seem to be allowed for single people."
"But do you want to be married? Both of you?"
Paula was looking at us both, her eyes moving from one to the other. I said truthfully, "Maud and I have not known each other long, nor had much chance to get to know each other. But we seem to work well together, and we understand each other pretty well, perhaps because of what we've been through in losing our families. Without you in the picture, it would be a while before we reached the point of discussing marriage, I think. However, that doesn't mean that the idea is a bad one. Still, some careful consideration is warranted."
"I'd be very happy to be your daughter," Paula said. "You don't talk down to me and you don't coddle me, but you do make me feel safe and valuable."
"What shall we do now?" Maud asked.
"Why don't we go for a walk and see if Father Walsh is willing to hear our idea and give us his reaction?"
"All right," Maud said. Paula was already getting on her jacket.
Part 43. It was a bit after 8 when we rang the bell at the house where Father Walsh and two other Catholic priests lived. The housekeeper ushered us into a room that looked like a dining room, with a fairly large table with chairs, and asked us to sit down. Walsh came in and joined us. I said, "Good evening, Father Walsh. We wonder if you have time to give us a few minutes to get some advice from you, or if not now, if we can arrange another time?"
"Better now, since you are all here," Father Walsh said. "How can I help you?"
"We are here because, since Paula has learnt that her parents are dead, her living situation with Mrs. Crichton and I may have become tenuous. The house we live in is owned by the council, and it has been suggested that it is not suitable for unrelated persons. A welfare worker has hinted that Mrs. Crichton and I might be considered inappropriate examples. I suppose all of those ideas have some consequence, but I suspect you have a more direct question. It has occurred to us that if we were a family, there would be no discussion. Thus we are wondering if it is appropriate for Maud and I to marry and adopt Paula. It would indeed solve some of the concerns, but marriage is a sacrament not to be treated as a convenience, though many do treat it so. Both Maud and I have known happy marriages. We have had daughters. We know the pros and cons. We are not head over heels in love, but there is affection and respect, and we get along better than most couples. Though it is but a short time since your arrival, Mr. Newman?
That is true, Father Walsh, Maud said. But many marriages made in the last few years have been built on much, much less.
Walsh nodded. And what of Miss Ronan? What do you think?
Paula said, Mr. Newman and Mrs. Crichton have been very kind, but also they have been very straightforward with me. They talk to me as a grown-up, which since my aunt's death and the realization I am an orphan, I know I must try to be. I would be very happy to be their daughter, if that's possible.
Well, the three of you at least seem unanimous in your wishes. This is a new situation for me. At least, it has never been put so directly to me, though perhaps others who presented themselves for marriage did not admit their concern. But you would make a handsome family, and you do all attend the church, though I understand, Mr. Newman, that you are not a Catholic.
That is true. Faith is a gift that has not been granted to me. But you are well aware that I supported my late wife and daughter in their religious observance, and will do so again. And truthfully, I find Mass important to me.
Yes. It is a pity some who claim full membership are less regular. Walsh said resignedly.
Have you any critical objections to what we suggest?
Maud asked.
No. I don't think I do, Father Walsh said. It may be just that our recent times put great store in romantic love. Respect and affection have a lot to commend them in marriage. And Paula has said you give her not only practical security, but also a sense of belonging to a family.
I would only counsel that you give it a few days' thought.
Then if you are still happy with your intentions, let me know by Saturday night so we can call the banns, and you could marry by the end of the month. Unless I mistake your story, there is concern that the council might act soon. While a special license would be even quicker, I would advise against it. The banns serve a good purpose in giving people a chance to consider what they are doing. And your intentions will be public, which should be enough to quiet some noise.
Thank you, Father Walsh. We'll let you know.
Part 44. The first banns were announced the following Sunday, and Maud and I got quite a few congratulations. It was also the day of a victory parade in London to celebrate the end of World War II. It had been more than a year since VE Day, with thousands of servicemen yet to be demobilized. Several hundred thousand German POWs were still detained in Britain, largely working as agricultural workers or in rebuilding destroyed roads and buildings. Some probably helped get things ready for the parade. Sunday afternoon, we wrote to Mrs. Carberry of our intentions as well as the tripartite wish that Paula become our adopted daughter. We were not sure whether the reaction would be a positive one, but by return of post got a short letter saying that our plan would solve a lot of problems. Well, Maud and I were certain that the letter meant one of Mrs. Carberry's problems would be solved. There were, after all, thousands of displaced persons all over Britain and the rest of Europe. Later that week, we visited Mr. Rushforth to set the legalities in motion. He had managed within a month to probate Mrs. Bonin's estate. He now set the adoption process in motion, but not before advising both Maud and I to prepare wills. We were a strange trio. Had we put the cart miles ahead of the horse? Here we were, doing the legalities before arranging the wedding or what we would wear to our wedding. We'd not thought about a reception. A cake. A honeymoon. Moreover, Thursday was June 13th. 2 years since the V1 killed Agnes and Peggy. After tea on Wednesday, Maud asked if I wanted to do anything to remember them. She'd clearly mentioned it to Paula in advance. We're all a bit careful not to tread too heavily around the soft spots in our lives.
Can we walk up to the site?
I asked.
Would you like to do it when you come home from work?
We could have. A late supper, or else have tea right away, then walk up there. Maybe before supper, I said, with no particular reason.
Should I get some flowers? Paula asked.
No, I think just having the two of you there will be about right, I answered. Part 44A. In the middle of the next week, I came home a bit earlier than usual. Maud was going to be late coming in from a meeting at Mrs. Carberry's office to complete some formalities, and we were still cautious not to leave Paula alone in the house. Perhaps too cautious. In any event, it was a nice evening, so I suggested Paula and I go for a walk. Without any planning, we wandered southwards to the Western Parade where we could watch the ships in Southampton Water. For the first several hundred yards, we said nothing. Then Paula asked, should I call you and Maud mother and father? You know, I'd not given that any thought, I answered. I'm not sure it sounds right compared to just Ted and Maud.
How do you feel?
I think I'm more comfortable calling you Ted and Maud. Mama and Papa were what I called my parents, and I think I want to keep them remembered that way.
That makes a lot of sense.
I know I've no wish to displace them in your thoughts, and I'm sure Maud feels the same. For us there are Peggy and Jenny to remember.
Yes.
I remember Jenny, and I think I may have met Peggy, but I think I was introduced to her as Margaret. I find the English use of Peggy for Margaret difficult.
It is a bit silly, isn't it?
I offered.
Do you miss her a lot? Paula asked.
Perhaps I shouldn't say this, I said, but I'm finding it more and more difficult to remember her precisely. I have to really struggle to remember exactly how she looked, the sound of her voice, the pattern of her feet on the stairs when she rushed down to meet me when I came home. I know that I used to have a clear memory of those things, but now the memories seem to be fading, and it makes me very anxious sometimes.
Oh, and I thought it was just me having trouble remembering.
What you said about Peggy's voice, that's what I find terribly hard to remember about Mama and Papa. And lately I remember them talking to me, but my memories have them talking English, which they never did to me. So I get all mixed up inside. But I didn't want to say anything because it seems like I'm failing them by not remembering properly.
We're all doing our best, but it doesn't seem enough, does it?
No. It'll never be enough, Paula said. We'd reached Archery Road playground and our rather maudlin conversation was cut short by an errant football from some boys who were playing 3A-side some distance away. Paula kicked the ball hard and sent it back to them.
Pity they don't let girls play football, I commented.
Yes. We play netball at school, but I think I'd prefer football. You could kick the ball hard and not be so cross with the world.
Should I buy a ball so we can do that?
I asked.
Possibly. but it won't really change things, will it? The important change is what you and Maud are doing. I'll do my best to help us be a family, Ted.
I thought of saying something more, but it seemed that Paula had summed up the situation as well as anyone could just at the moment. We got to the parade and watched the water and a couple of ships for a few minutes, then made our way back by a slightly different route in time to arrive just as Maud was coming in. Part 44b. On Saturday, June 15th, Enid Brownlow invited us for tea. Maud had invited her to be her matron of honor. Initially, we were just going to have two witnesses, but somehow people around us were absolutely convinced that we should have a proper wedding. I had already asked George Cummings if he'd stand up for me, and he'd agreed. Paula had gone to a matinee at a cinema with a school friend, so there were just the three of us along with Jack, who was busy with a set of wooden blocks. Those belonged to Fred when he was a nipper, Enid explained. She poured our tea, then asked, "Did you find the dress you want to adjust to work as a wedding outfit?" "Yes, and it seems to have avoided moth or mice damage. It needs a touch of adjusting, but I think it will do. I'll be using my demob suit, I'm afraid," I said.
"Will you have a honeymoon?" Enid asked.
"I'll have to talk to Supermarine. I've only been back since February, but I actually didn't have any leave since the beginning of 1944, so I expect they'll give me a few days. If you bring Paula's cot over here, she can stay with me for a few days." Maud said, "Thank you, Enid. That's really generous." After we got home from Enid, I said, "I better sort out things with Supermarine Monday or Tuesday so we know what our options are. Do you have any particular wishes, Maud?"
"Mainly to have a bit of time to ourselves to get used to each other.
What about you?"
"Essentially the same. We'll need to get used to being in the same bed, unless you want separate beds."
"No. And we already know we can sleep together, even in a single bed."
"True.
Did you and Jeremy find comfort in each other's arms?"
"I suppose. We were younger then, and didn't think about the comfort of being together quite as much."
Paula wasn't home. I put my arms round Maud and kissed her. We spent a few minutes with me leaning against the back door smooching. This was new to us, but we seemed to both enjoy it. Once again, Paula came home to interrupt us. Part 45. As we were walking home from church the next morning, one of Paula's schoolmates said hello as she passed us by on a bicycle. I said, "It's a pity we only have one bike between us as yet." Paula responded, "It wouldn't make much difference as I've never learnt to ride."
"Then we'll have to teach you. It could make getting to school easier."
"Yes. Some of the girls ride to school. It saves them time." Thus that afternoon, we adjusted the saddle of the bicycle, the fact it was a women's pattern now an advantage, and taught Paula to ride. She learnt quickly, and after an hour or so was moderately competent. After a few evenings of practice, the bicycle was truly hers. Part 45a. On Tuesday, I already had a short meeting scheduled with Gooch at 8:30. I was able to tell him that my team had the parts management for the attacker organized and ready to implement. This pleased him. We would also be continuing the Griffin parts system for the Spikeful. "I gather you have been re-establishing your life, Newman."
"I have indeed, Mr. Gooch. Did Miss Shoreham tell you that I plan to get married on the 29th?
"She did, and I wonder if you would think of taking a short holiday with your bride in Derbyshire.
There is a meeting at Rolls-Royce in Derby about the Neen engine on July 5th that I'd rather like you to attend, but I'll be happy to pay for you and your wife to get there and back and for a couple of nights of your accommodation in Derby. While I intend to make all such decisions mutual with Maud, I am fairly certain that we'll be happy to take up your offer, Mr. Gooch. As I was walking back to my office, I was about to come round the corner of one of the passageways when I heard the squeak of the tea trolley and Mrs. Noonan, the tea lady, said to someone near my office. It must have been one of the char women who tidied the offices. Did you hear his Nibs is marrying his landlady? The other replied, yeah. Wonder how far up the spout she is. Widow and widower, their families not much more than one foot in the grave. The gossip mill was churning. I decided not to cause an embarrassing meeting and quietly snuck back down the corridor to the toilet door, where I could make a hasty retreat or else appear to be returning from a call of nature. Mrs. Noonan said they've been coming to church regular like since he got demobbed. But he's not a Catholic even. Bit hypocritical if you ask me. Yeah. Can't think a situation like that can be all innocent. I opened and then shut the toilet door loudly and walked briskly back to my office so my footsteps would be heard. The two ladies looked away and pretended to be busy. I was more disappointed than angry. Part 46. Maud was indeed happy about the idea of accepting Gooch's offer. Oh. I thought we'd at most go for a night or two to Bournemouth. Well, what about a few nights in London, then go to Derby on the 4th? You'll have to entertain yourself on July 5th in Derby, but the two nights there will be on expenses, and also the train. We found a hotel in Chelsea for our London nights and I used the telephone to book a room with a private bath. Extravagant, but I thought worthwhile. Part 47. 161, Radstock Road. Woolston, Hampshire. June 20th, 1946. Nigel Hughes. Hughes Salvage Limited. Leicester. Dear Nigel. Just a quick note to give you some news. Rather sooner than either of us expected, my landlady Maud and I have decided to get married. On the 29th, in fact. No, don't jump to false conclusions. The realities are, I think, somewhat more serious and more sensible. In any event, our honeymoon, if it can be called that, is being subsidized by Supermarine because they want me to attend a meeting with Rolls in Derby on the 5th of July. It struck me that we could come to Leicester on the Saturday, stay overnight and say hello, then come back to Southampton on the Sunday the 7th. If this fits with your plans, let me know. We'll need a hotel room if you know of something nice. Our budget can cover anything below Claridge's or the Ritz. Your pal. Ted. I got my answer the following Monday afternoon by telephone. Ted. I guess you want me to use that now we're in Civvy Street. You're staying at the Star Inn in Thrussington. My shout, and I won't take any argument. Tell Maud Queen Elizabeth or someone else historic slept there. I just hope they've changed the sheets. Nigel was always a bit of a card. Thanks, Nigel. I suspect we'll take a morning train and arrive on Saturday around midday, but I'll phone you from Derby on the Friday. I'm likely to be out, but there's someone in the office until 5:30, so you can leave the time the train arrives with whoever answers. I'll meet you on the platform. Look for a tweed cap with an RAF badge pinned on the front if it's crowded. Part 48. We hadn't really thought out a reception, and we hadn't sent out real invitations, but told people we knew we were going to marry at St. Patrick's at 10 a.m. and have a reception in the garden at the back of 161 Radstock Road. Given the rationing, people were very generous in bringing things. We did manage a modest cake, and I got in some beer and some cider. The main worry was rain. As it turned out, not too bad. And we were fortunate that bread for sandwiches wouldn't be rationed until July 21st. Flour disappeared quickly from shop shelves. Maud and Paula went into shops separately and managed to get a total of 6 bags. I suppose we were being hoarders. It was hard not to. A lot of long faces and angry comments about this move, since bread hadn't been rationed for the entire war. The claim was that there were people starving in Germany. Quite a few remarks of "let the bastards starve," which ignored the fact that a lot of the starving were the people overrun or displaced by the Wehrmacht. We were a bit shocked that there were about 2 dozen people in the garden, but almost everyone brought something to contribute to a modest feast. Enid and George told us to stay until noon, then get on our way. They and Paula would make sure things were tidied up. Paula surprised us by finding a key to the inside kitchen door. It was probably a very common key, but it would mean we could avoid people going into the rest of the house. Paula said we'll want to come and go in the kitchen, but I don't want people wandering through the house when we're not around. But we'll want to come in and out of the kitchen. And there was, fortunately, a toilet next to the coal shed. Part 49. By 1:30 we were halfway to London. Someone had a car to drive us to Southampton Central. My suitcase and Maud's were more full than I can previously recall. Well, I would need to be presentable on Friday. I'd use the suit that used to be Jeremy's between today and Friday. It was good material, but if you looked carefully, it wasn't a perfect fit. Thinking we may want to have raincoats with us, but not always wear them in the summer weather, I'd bought a modest rucksack I'd found secondhand. It would serve us well for this trip. Already we had our coats in it as the temperature was mild. We took a taxi to the hotel. There was the interesting moment after I said, "Good afternoon. The name's Newman. We have a reservation." The clerk replied, "Ah, yes. Mr. and Mrs. Newman. You're with us until Thursday. I hope you have a nice stay. Could you just complete the entry in the register, please?" There wasn't a porter in this hotel, which was pleasant but modest. Our room was just one floor up. I unlocked the door and we took in our luggage. Maud went through to the small bathroom. "It's nice. I've never stayed in a place like this." "Yes. It is nice." We were silent for a moment. I shut the door and put the key in the keyhole. "Shall I lock it?" I asked. "Oh, yes. Should lock it anyway." "Anyway?" I queried. "Ted, we're not children. And we just got married." "Sorry. Just teasing a little." "I know. I feel a bit awkward, that's all." "So do I. Worse than the first time with Agnes, I think. Oh, I shouldn't have mentioned her. Sorry." "Don't be sorry. We'll get ourselves tied up in knots if we try to tiptoe around the memories. The best thing about you coming into my life is that we tell each other how we're feeling about things. I don't think Jeremy and I did that, or not as openly." Maud was near the window, which had some sheer curtains as well as some heavy ones. Likely needed for the blackout. We embraced and then kissed. Not a long kiss, but a nice one. "Do you want to go out for a bit and look around?" I asked. "It'll be light until late. I think I'd like to..."
Would it help to sit in the bath together?
We really aren't very familiar with each other physically.
All right, but you'll get the taps. And I hope you won't be disappointed. I'm not a young girl anymore.
I'll love you anyway, I said.
Yes. I believe you will. And I you.
Part 50. It was about 6 o'clock when we stepped out of the hotel and began to explore the area around the hotel. After about an hour, we found a small restaurant with a Greek name. We managed to get a pleasant meal with some dishes that were new to us. Moussaka was one. And spanakopita another. And a chicken soup with rice and lemon. Finally, some very small and sticky pastry called baklava. We were offered some red wine called retsina, but I remembered a friend saying the taste was unusual, so I asked if we could just have a sip first. That turned out to be sensible, as we didn't find it very interesting and chose some beer instead.
This was really different, Ted. I could get used to being on honeymoon with you.
That's good. I was a bit afraid I'd caused you pain this afternoon when you sort of gasped and let out a little cry.
Actually, just the opposite. Especially when you kiss me, all over.
Jeremy never did that. It was...
I guess I can understand why you thought I was in pain.
Really intense.
Actually, I'd never done that with Agnes, either. It just seemed that after the bath, when we could see each other's...
bits?
I was curious, then, somehow, it seemed to be what I should do.
Yes.
Well, I liked it, and it seems you liked it, and we both seemed to have a good time. I'm glad we thought to put down a towel. I'd be mortified to think the housekeeping staff would be able to figure out what we'd been doing.
We are married now, Maud.
Yes. I've still got to get used to that.
Do you think we did the right thing to reuse your wedding ring?
Waste of money to get another. And you've got Agnes' ring still.
Are you interested in either of them?
They're in the locked drawer by my bed.
Well, now it'll be Paula's bed, I guess.
No. Actually, I don't have much interest in jewelry.
You can't use it for much, can't eat it.
You have to worry about it being stolen, and then you have trouble selling it if you need money.
The jewelers won't like to hear that, but a parsimonious husband will be happy.
Do you think you're parsimonious, Ted?
I guess there's lots still to learn about each other.
I think I'm cautious with money, but I don't think I'm afraid to spend.
Consider the hotel room.
Actually, I was a bit put out that you booked such an expensive room.
Or relatively expensive anyway.
But having the bathroom turned out to be an inspiration.
It wasn't intentional.
More a matter that I don't like having to get up and put on clothes to go to the toilet in the middle of the night.
Or even in the morning before I've shaved.
That does make sense.
And especially after?
Well, I was very wet this afternoon.
It's been a while for me.
And I'm sorry it was rather quick.
Talking about it has me wanting to get back to the hotel.
Mrs. Newman, I'm not sure that's proper language for a good Catholic lady.
Not even for a good married Catholic lady.
Oh. What about church tomorrow?
Part 51. We discovered that our hotel was only a few minutes' walk from the Church of Our Most Holy Redeemer and St. Thomas More. However, the hotel told us it had been hit by a bomb in September 1940, with 19 people killed. But St. Mary's on Cadogan Street had an 8 o'clock mass, and the hotel breakfast could be had until 10 on Sunday. Maud decided to take communion, as this fitted the timing. The 8 o'clock service was quite short, with a very modest sermon.
the hotel was able to offer a particularly good traditional breakfast. Where they found the eggs, I don't know. We accepted the luxury and the quite high price. It was worth it. The rest of the day we spent sightseeing. A lot, sadly, included bomb damage. We'd walk for a bit, then take a bus. I'd had the foresight to go to the bank midweek and get a roll of tanners and one of threepenny bits, as well as a good collection of shillings, florins, and half crowns. And of course some notes, to a total of £25 actually. Last night I found Maud had put £15 in her handbag too. After our enthusiasm to enjoy each other on our return from the Greek restaurant, we'd talked about what we might do during our time, and the topic of money caused us to consider how we should be a bit careful with it in case there were pickpockets about. Maud now had half my coin in her handbag, but had pinned an envelope of notes in the pocket of her costume jacket. I'd done the same with half my notes in my suit jacket. Some of the coin was in the rucksack with our coats and a lemonade bottle I'd refilled with water. My coin purse was rather full, but it turned out we used quite a few sixpences on the buses we took during the next few days. I didn't have a camera. It was blown up, I guess, with the V1. But Maud did, and she'd bought 3 films during the previous week. Enid had been present enough to ensure that some pictures were taken of the wedding. Maud and I clearly were not focused on such matters, to express it aptly, but now I was glad someone was. And I noticed that George's wife was taking pictures, as was Ralph Dixon. We'd have to ask for prints. We didn't go into any museums or attractions. The places were enough, and there were more than enough to keep us busy for a few days, as we were not in a rush. One thing the hotel arranged, for a commission of course, was tickets to Sleeping Beauty at Covent Garden on Tuesday evening. For each of us, the first ballet we'd seen in person. I think I'd seen some ballet sequences in some film or other, and perhaps Maud had too. Before breakfast on Wednesday, I did the Prince Charming bit and woke Maud with a kiss. Her response was, "I don't think Prince Charming should be wearing pajamas, or Sleeping Beauty any nightgown." After the natural consequence of this invitation, we lay in each other's arms. It was still quite early. Well, it wasn't yet 8 o'clock. "Maud, are you still having monthlies?" I asked. We lived in the same house, but I had no idea. "Yes. Probably start on the weekend. Are you wondering about the possibility of babies?" "Yes. We've talked about all sorts of other things, but not that." "Would you be bothered by a baby, Ted? Would you want me to have one?" This will seem very silly, but I haven't given it any thought. My mind was on other things, and not what we've just been doing. My focus was looking after you and Paula. "I know, or at least I could feel that. But would you be upset, or would you be happy? I suppose we should have talked about this beforehand." "I wouldn't be upset. It would be a big change, especially at our time of life. But I'd be happy about a child. I'll also be happy even if one doesn't come about. Well, after Jenny, I had some sort of infection, and the doctor said it wasn't likely I'd get pregnant again. I didn't with Jeremy, and we had a pretty normal married life. Though the last few days have given me something a bit different that I didn't experience before." "Me too. Agnes and I probably had what you called normal married life, and she didn't fall pregnant again after Margaret. She even went to the doctor to ask about it. But she'd had a difficult birth with Margaret. And like you, I think there may have been an infection." "We'll see what comes, then. And enjoy ourselves too." "Yes. Maud, I think we will."